You're listening to a Dwell Community Church production. If you'd like to check out more resources, visit dwellcc.org.
Okay. Yeah, so if you were with us before Snowmageddon, 2 weeks ago, we were talking about this super powerful Babylonian king, King Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar had a very disturbing dream involving a colossal statue where each part of the statue represented different human kingdoms. Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom, was the head of gold. These other body parts were other human kingdoms. And at the end of Nebuchadnezzar's dream, this stone comes out of nowhere. This is the coolest part of my PowerPoint from last time. And it obliterates the statue. And what we're supposed to get from this is that God's eternal kingdom will displace all of the other human kingdoms that precede it. Now, one clear implication of this, if you're Nebuchadnezzar, is that his beloved kingdom of Babylon would not last. And he really, really did not like that. And so we read at the beginning of chapter 3, Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, the height of which was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits, and he set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar's like, how about this instead? Yeah, okay, God, thanks for sharing your view of history. That's cool. But what about my kingdom, solid gold, head to foot, enduring forever? How about that? Why don't we go with that instead? What is this? This is just brazen pride, man. This is just unbridled human pride. Babylon! That's what this vision's about, and this is a common problem with human beings. We're very proud, like these little ants, just kind of strutting around like peacocks before this being that made the universe. God doesn't like that. He talks about this quite a bit. Pride and arrogance, I hate, just in case you're wondering what his take is, right? Pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before stumbling. God's opposed to the proud. Yeah, I could bury you with screen after screen of verses where God says pride is bad. And that's, and it's, you know, you just got to think from God's perspective. He looks at us, these little creatures that are here today, gone tomorrow, people like Nebuchadnezzar raising their fist in defiance against him. And it's just like, seriously? There's something, it's more than just wrong, it's delusional. It's like, come on. And yet, as delusional as we can get, and in self-inflated as we can be, one thing we're seeing in this book is that God keeps going after us. Out of love, remarkably, he is willing to care for prideful people if they'll just turn to him. Look at this verse. God opposes the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Jesus Christ came into our world and laid his life down to die for rebels like us on the cross. If we'll turn in humility and acknowledge that he is God and that we are not. And that's really what this whole story is about. It's about a loving God who will not tolerate pride, but who will extend grace to us if we'll just humble ourselves before him. That's what this is about. And so Nebuchadnezzar makes this enormous statue. And then he puts the word out to all the movers and shakers in Babylon that there's going to be a statue dedication ceremony. And so the satraps, prefects, and governors, and counselors, treasurers, judges, magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up, and they stood before the image. So this must have been a very impressive sight. You know, they put the statue on a plane to kind of heighten its sense of majesty And this is a sunny part of the world, this golden statue shimmering in the sun, surrounded by all these people wearing the best clothes they have, right? Super impressive. And then it says this herald loudly proclaims, "To you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar has set up." Now, why the music? It's like an orchestra, right? Why? Probably to evoke a sense of awe. I was reading about the nighttime rallies that Hitler held at Nuremberg. And they would play, I think it was Wagner, who was very anti-Semitic. They played a lot of songs that had kind of a Nordic Aryan theme. And it was all cultivated to evoke a sense of devotion and awe before Hitler. That's exactly what it was for. These guys were probably shooting for something similar. But just in case it wasn't enough, this guy shouts, "And whoever doesn't fall down and worship shall be immediately cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire." So just in case you're on the edge, this is your extra motivation. Now, we know for a fact that the Babylonians used fire to kill people. They had these brick kilns, charcoal-fired brick kilns, that were kind of shaped like a kind of a curved roof Quonset hut, like a rec center. And they would have chimneys through the roof, and one side would be open. And they would put people in these furnaces and burn them alive. It was a horrible way to die. And we know for a fact they did this from sources outside the Bible. And so, knowing the cost of disobedience, yeah, at that time, when everybody heard the band play, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down, and they worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar set up. So obviously, you know, what are you going to do? Bow down or die? Well, surprisingly, you would think everybody would do that, but we know for a fact some of the people on the plane looking at that statue, surrounded by a sea of people bowing down, like you'd see at Mecca or something like that. Some people stood and they refused to bow, which is, man, just think about that. A sea of people and you're the one person who's not bowing. Who were these guys? Well, Nebuchadnezzar has a lot of people working for him in his administration, and some of them come to him saying, "O king, live forever. There are certain Jews," this kind of has racial connotations here, "who you appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, they've disregarded you. They don't serve your gods or worship the golden image which you've set up." This is like, you can just hear them, they're hissing like snakes, right? Tattling on these three men. "These are Daniel's friends. We've read about them. They were kidnapped by Nebuchadnezzar, torn from their families when he conquered Jerusalem, brought to Babylon, indoctrinated. They resisted indoctrination. And then, even though they were prisoners, with God's help, they were elevated by Nebuchadnezzar himself to these top positions in Babylon. And that did not escape the notice of other court officials who hated these guys for that. They come in, they realize, oh, this is our chance to go after Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And so they point out, they have, look at this, disregarded you. Now, this is the thing about being proud. When you're proud, you know, the thought is, this is going to protect me. If I'm kind of sticking up for myself and being prideful, this is a way to protect myself. But it actually makes you more vulnerable. These guys knew Nebuchadnezzar was proud. And because he was proud, he was very easy to manipulate. And so they frame the disobedience of these three men as a personal insult to the king. They've disregarded you. And predictably, he explodes. They punch his buttons. He does exactly what they want him to do. Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and anger, gave orders to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and then these men were brought before the king. Nebuchadnezzar responded and said, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you don't serve my gods or worship the golden images that I've set up?" He is kind of puzzled because if you're Nebuchadnezzar, you've taken these ragtag refugees, elevated them to these awesome jobs, and you're like, are you seriously, after everything, not going to do this? And so he gives them one more chance. He's like, if you're ready, at the moment that the band strikes up, I'm not going to keep reading that over and over again. If you're ready to fall down and worship this image after I play the music, cool, it's all good. But if you don't worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And listen to this. And what God is there who can deliver you out of my hands? Oh, you want to talk about pushing someone's buttons. This is Almighty God. Are you seriously saying that no one, not even Daniel's God, is going to be able to stop you from killing these men? That is titanic arrogance and pride. Yeah, come on, dude. I think, and this is crazy too, because Nebuchadnezzar, he had seen Daniel tell him his own dream. He was so blown away by God's power back in chapter 2. He told Daniel, your God is the God of gods and the Lord of lords. And now he's acting like he's God. It just shows you how quickly our memory can fade, right? How we can get something, but then over time our pride comes seeping back in. Well, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego replied, Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to give you an answer concerning this matter. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. It's like, we do know a God who can help us here. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he doesn't, let it be known to you, O king, that we're not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you've set up. I think some of the most powerful words in this entire book are right here. Even if he doesn't. They're basically saying, you know, we, unlike you, are willing to completely entrust ourselves to God, our future to God. This is so different than Nebuchadnezzar's pride. They're completely putting themselves at God's disposal. They're getting underneath what God's wants and being loyal to him. That is the opposite of pride. This is somebody who's just getting underneath God and following him. And they, in saying this, they're actually willing to faithfully serve God, even if it means getting killed or hurt. And that's sobering because you know what? God does not promise us that he'll protect us from getting hurt if we stay close to him. That's just not how it works. What we're reading about here is similar to a promise that Paul makes in 2 Timothy. He tells Timothy, all who desire to live godly in Christ will be persecuted. Now, obviously, we don't want to sin against people and provoke being mistreated. But the fact is, if you follow God, the kind of God who was humble enough to lay his life down as a servant, there will be a clash of values. And we will inevitably, we're going to be misconstrued. There'll be misunderstandings, sometimes slander or worse, depending on the kind of place we live in. Some of us right here, I know because I've talked with you over the last few months, are enduring some undeserved persecution, some ostracism because you're trying to follow God. I get that. That happens all the time. And so this is one of these things. They're just like, yeah, with our eyes wide open. We know what the cost is, and we're going to go ahead and stick by God all the way through this. Well, Nebuchadnezzar has no category for that. So it says, check this out. He was filled with wrath, and his facial expression was altered. He's like, you know, he just totally angry. He answered by giving orders to heat the furnace 7 times more than it was usually heated. It's an idiom, just like turn it up to 11. He commanded certain valiant warriors who were in his army to tie up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in order to cast them into the furnace of blazing fire. Then these men were tied up in their trousers, their coats, their caps. Didn't even take the time to, like, you know, strip them down. Just throw them in with all their clothes on, and they were thrown in. Not good. And it says, for this reason, because the king's command was urgent and the furnace was made so hot, the flame of the fire slew those men who carried up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Which sucks. These valiant warriors, their lives wasted just because he's totally pissed off. And it says the three men also fell into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. And so, I don't know if you've ever been around the combination of pride and rage. You guys ever been around someone who is proud and furious? I have. I've been that person. It's terrifying. It's really horrible. When we get swept away with our pride and you throw in a little rage, people get hurt, man. There's collateral damage. It's, you know, some of the worst things... I've ever done right here, that combination. Needless deaths here. This is just so typical of pride and rage. Very dangerous combination. Well, Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded. Even though these guys go in, he watches his own dudes, his valiant warriors die, but the guys that went in, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, nothing's happening to them. It says that Nebuchadnezzar the king was astounded, and he stood up in haste. He said to his high officials, "Was it not 3 men we cast bound into the midst of fire?" They replied to the king, "Certainly, O king." He said, "Look, I see 4 men loosed and walking about in the midst of the fire without harm, and the appearance of the 4th is like the Son of God." Yeah, so there's been a lot of speculation. Who was that 4th person in the furnace? And we just don't know. Could have been an angel. Maybe it was Jesus. The one thing we do know is whoever was in there was basically communicating that God is with these men. It was a way of God saying, I have solidarity with you in the midst of this. Another way we could word this, what we're reading about here, is that God didn't deliver them from the furnace, but he was with them through it. And that theme is really all the way through the New Testament. The idea that, no, you serve me, you may get hurt. Actually, if you purpose to serve me, you will be persecuted. The promise isn't to deliver us from it, it's to be with us through it. And so think about Stephen, New Testament. He was preaching the gospel, and he was getting stoned to death, right? And right before he died, it says that he saw the heavens open and he saw Jesus standing at the right hand of God. So Jesus was with him in that moment. If you read about Paul when he was on death row, Paul was sitting there, you know, realizing he was about to die. And he says that, you can read 2 Timothy 4, he says, God was standing with me. So I don't know how it works in every situation. But if you serve God and you run into some kind of fiery furnace, he may not deliver you from it, but he will be with you through it. And that is an awesome, awesome promise that we have here. That's what Jesus was talking about when he told people that follow him, I'll be with you always. So we can hold on to that promise. Now, Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the furnace. They must have turned the heat down. I don't know how else he could do that. He responded and said, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, come out, you servants of the Most High God, and come here. And then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out of the midst of the fire. What was the one thing that burned here? The ropes, right? That's the only thing that burned away. The satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's high officials gathered around and saw in regard to these men that the fire had no effect on the bodies, nor was the hair of their head singed, nor were their trousers damaged, nor had the smell of fire even come upon them. no effect on them whatsoever. Incredible display of power. Unbelievable. I mean, who has lived to see something like this? And of course, Nebuchadnezzar has a predictable response. This is how he always responds. He's like, whoa, that was cool. He's like, blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. All of a sudden, he's like, yeah, whoa, God's amazing. He sent his angel. That was his take. We don't know who that fourth person was. And delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command. They yielded up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their God. And so he's like, I am impressed with God. He's amazing. Very, very, very powerful. And so what do you think? Is this it? Is this the end of Nebuchadnezzar's pride? Oh, no. Oh, no. Not even close. It's going to take a little more work for God to put Nebuchadnezzar on his stringer. It's going to take a bit here. A little bit later, getting into chapter 4, it says Nebuchadnezzar, and interestingly, he's the one writing this chapter that's been included in the Bible. It says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and flourishing in my palace, and I saw a dream, and it made me fearful. So another disturbing dream. And these fantasies as I lay on my bed and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. So he has a disturbing dream. Now, a couple of things tell us we've jumped ahead in Nebuchadnezzar's life a couple decades. One is that it's a period of peace. We know that there was a period of peace and prosperity toward the end of his reign. He also describes having completed his building projects. And so think about your career, reaching that point that corporate people call convergence. Have you guys ever heard this term? Like you've kind of mastered your craft. You're starting to see the impact of your work. People are coming to you for input. You're reaching this point where you've really achieved a lot. That's the stage in Nebuchadnezzar's life he's in. And what do you think might just start creeping in at a stage like that? Pride. Yeah, totally pride. Yeah, so he's starting to feel pretty good. However, he has another disturbing dream. He's like, I saw a dream and it made me fearful, and these fantasies that I lay on my bed and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. So I gave orders to bring into my presence all the wise men of Babylon that they might make known to me this what this means. And then the magicians, conjurers, Chaldeans, and diviners came in, and I related the dream to them. But guess what happened? What always happens? They couldn't figure out what it meant. Surprise, surprise, right? These guys, they've just not been able to do anything useful the whole time. It makes you really wonder. Now, Nebuchadnezzar, come on, dude. Why didn't you just go straight to Daniel? And he's the guy that's able to answer these questions. Well, check this out. It says, finally, Daniel came in. So apparently, Daniel couldn't be a first responder. He was maybe too far away. And he got the word, and it took him a while. But when he finally got there, the king started to explain this vision that he had, this dream. He says, these were the visions in my mind, this disturbing dream I had as I lay on my bed. He's like, I was looking, and behold, there was this tree in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree grew large and became strong, and its height reached the sky, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. So this massive, tall tree, its foliage was beautiful, its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the sky dwelt in its branches. And all living creatures fed themselves from it. So this is this kind of this big, protective, life-giving tree that has a huge effect on the world around it. I was looking in the visions as in my mind as I lay in my bed, and behold, an angelic watcher. Now remember, Nebuchadnezzar's a pagan king. He's just kind of writing, he's just describing this from his perspective. I don't know what an angelic watcher is. It's just something he saw. He sees this watcher, a holy one, probably an angel would be my guess. And he shouted out and spoke as follows: chop down the tree, cut off its branches, strip off its foliage, scatter its fruit. Let the beasts flee from under it and the birds from its branches, yet leave the stump with its roots in the ground. but with a band of iron and bronze around it in the new grass of the field, and let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him share with the beasts and the grass of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him." Okay. Now, there's something really weird happening right in the middle of verse 15. He starts out talking about a tree that becomes a stump, and he uses the pronoun it to refer to the stump. He says, it has roots that go into the ground. But then as he's talking about it, the stump, he calls it a him. And it's a person, a man whose mind is turned into the mind of a beast. And so there's 2 things. There's this tree that's cut down to a stump, and then there's this man who's given the mind of a beast. They're basically 2 images of the same thing that he's talking about here. And then Daniel, whose name is Belshazzar, was appalled. You see, if you read this, Nebuchadnezzar's like, you can tell he understands parts of it, but there's a lot that he doesn't understand. As Daniel's listening, he gets it. He knows exactly what the dream is about. And it says that he gets really appalled and alarmed by what he's heard. And if you're Nebuchadnezzar and you're looking at your wise man that you trust and he's disturbed, that's a bad sign, right? Very bad sign. So the king notices. He's like, Belteshazzar, Daniel, don't let the dream or its interpretation alarm you. He's like, hey, man, it's okay. And Daniel comes back. He says, my Lord, if only the dream applied to those who hate you and its interpretation to your adversaries. And I just quickly wanted to point out, you know, part of what God wants to do is use us to reach proud people. We're proud. God's reached us. Everyone in the planet's proud. And God wants to use us to love people that are far from God. And that's, look at how we see Daniel doing this. I think this is pretty amazing. You know, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Daniel's homeland. He tore Daniel away from his family. He, on multiple occasions, threatened to kill Daniel and his friends. And now, out of love for this man, Daniel is genuinely concerned for him. I think we talked about this a couple weeks ago. What a picture of how the kindness of God can lead folks to turn back to him, right? This is God's working through Daniel in a powerful way here. And so he finally breaks the bad news. That tree you saw, it's you, O king, for you have become great and grown strong, and your majesty's become great and reached to the sky, and your dominion to the end of the earth. That's the interpretation, O king. This is the decree of the Most High. This is a message from God to you. You are going to be taken down. You're going to be driven away from mankind. Your dwelling place is going to be with the beasts of the field. You're going to be given grass to eat like cattle and be drenched with the dew of heaven. So yeah, 7 periods of time will pass over you until you recognize. So the whole point of what God's about to do in your life, Nebuchadnezzar, is so that you'll recognize that the Most High is ruler over the realm of mankind, and he bestows rule over on whom he wishes. Okay, so pretty simple. You're the tree, and you're going to be cut down. You will live like, you're the man who's going to live like an animal, and it's going to happen until you finally admit that God's in charge. Now, if I'm Daniel, this is probably a good place to stop talking, right? Like, let's just kind of land the plane right here. But he doubles down, man. He keeps going. He's like, therefore, O king, may my advice be pleasing to you. Break away now from your sins. I bet nobody had ever talked to Nebuchadnezzar like this. I got an idea. Why don't you stop your sinful ways by doing righteousness, and from your break away from your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor in case there might be a prolonging of your prosperity. You know, it's interesting. We know for a fact, not just Nebuchadnezzar, but all of the Babylonian kings were merciless to the poor. They would go in and conquer territories, They would deport the nobility. They would take all the resources out of the areas that they conquered. And then they would leave the remaining people in the land utterly destitute. They impoverished hundreds of thousands of people by their policies. And you know what's interesting is, what was the effect of impoverishing all these conquered peoples? It lowered their tax revenue, and that eventually led to the erosion and collapse of this empire. This is why the Medes and Persians were able to come in. It's because the Babylonians weakened their population so much they didn't have the means to defend themselves. And this is something in our pride and in our self-promotion and self-assertion and selfishness. Not only does God look at that and go, man, that's offensive. He's like, that's just dumb. Like, there's a better way to live. I mean, the idea that God could look at our lives and just go, okay, you have the dignity to set your own course. That's, you go for it. But do you have the humility to realize it isn't working? How is rebellion against God going? How is living on our own terms, our own way going? Do we have the humility to admit that maybe there's a better way? That's this appeal that is being made with Nebuchadnezzar here. Hey, man, it could be better. You could care for the poor and flourish. So what about that? It's an alternative to our pride. God says, not just it's wrong, I've got something better for you. Well, 12 months pass. That, I'm sure, imagine having a talk with Daniel. I'm sure the king really, really thought about what Daniel said. But 12 months went by. 12 months, that's a long time. And he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. The king was reflecting and said, is this not Babylon the Great, which I myself have built as a royal residence by the might of my power and for the glory of my majesty? Once again, pride is totally roaring back in this guy's life, right? He's surveying everything that he's made. You know what's amazing is we have dug up tablets, multiple tablets, where the Nebuchadnezzar of history says exactly this. Here's one tablet. These fortifications I strengthened and established my reign forever. That's chiseled on a clay tablet somewhere from the time of Nebuchadnezzar. Here's another one. In Babylon, my dear city, which I love, was the palace, the house of wonder of the people, the bond of the land, the brilliant place, the abode of the majesty in Babylon. He truly was an egomaniac. It's this documented case of pride here. So yeah, what is going on? He had seen the power of God. He had heard Daniel interpret his dreams. He watched three men walk through fire and not be burned. He heard the loving, concerned words from a wise counselor, and yet he's still proud. What is it? He's seen all this. What's happening is his convictions are fading. We know multiple occasions Nebuchadnezzar was deeply struck by God's power. But you know how it is. We get convicted about something and a little time passes and those convictions fade. I can think of things in my life, without getting into the gory details, that I've felt profoundly convicted about, persuaded that needed to be changed. But then you know how it is. You're like, that's a thing, and I'll get to that. And then a week goes by or 2 weeks go by and you're starting to lose a grip on what stirred you. And then pretty soon you're starting to kind of question even whether or not that was the right way to think about things. And it doesn't take long. You just wake up and realize, I've totally forgotten whatever that conviction was. Sometimes you discover it later, like, oh yeah, that's so typical of human nature. And is it possible, like, if you've been kind of like somebody who's doing your own thing, and maybe you've sensed deep down for years, you've sensed that God is there and that he's pursuing you and that it would be good to turn to him. And you've thought about it, but you put it off and put it off and put it off and put it off. You know what will happen? Like, you leave this room, Like me, like a lot of Sundays, I leave here and I completely forget what happened in this room. I turn on the TV, watch a basketball game, and it's pretty much gone. And I would just appeal to you, if you're feeling any conviction right now about the need to turn to God, do it now before you get back in your car and forget about everything we're talking about. You can do what Daniel appealed to Nebuchadnezzar to do. You can go to God, own the fact that you do wrong. We all do wrong, right? And then appeal to God to forgive you and tell him, I want to follow you. Do it now, sitting in your seat before the conviction fades. That's one thing we can learn. That's a way to avoid what happens next to Nebuchadnezzar. So while the world was in the king's mouth, so while he's surveying his kingdom and talking about how great he is, a voice came from heaven saying, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it's declared sovereignty has been removed from you. And immediately the word concerning Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled, and he was driven away from mankind and began eating grass like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. Yeah, right there. Not a vision, not a dream, an audible voice, you're fired. It's over. And this is the heart of the issue, isn't it? This is where the struggle is between us and God. Who is in charge? Who's going to call the shots? Who are we going to respect and listen to, ourselves or God? And in this case, you know, this is not a unique thing for him. It's something we all battle with. This is the heart of pride in all of us. Are we going to bend the knee and admit we live in somebody else's universe that brought us here? I know that's a hard word, but that is a core issue with coming to God, is just admitting, you're God, not me. Now, I know some of you are asking, is there any evidence that Nebuchadnezzar lost his mind for a while? Because we do have a lot of information about this period of history, and actually, there was this Babylonian tablet dug up. It was translated in 1975. Now, there's some debate if this is describing Nebuchadnezzar or his son, evil Merodach, but his son or him, the idea that was there a tradition connected to Babylonian royalty showing them losing their mind for a while? And there was. In this case, it describes this king's life appearing of no value, how he doesn't show love to his son, the family and clan don't exist. So the idea that there was a period where Nebuchadnezzar was checked out, that's completely plausible and consistent with the records we have from ancient Babylon. There was a stretch in his life where he seemed like he was kind of losing it. Now, why? What made him act like an animal? Have you guys ever heard of boanthropy? It's a clinical condition where people act like cattle. This is a thing. They graze on grass. They moo. they do the kind of things that cows do. Some of you, maybe someone here has had it. You can tell us about it later. But it's a curable disease. That's one thing for sure. I don't know. I don't know what caused him to act this way. I guess I do know, right? God humbled Nebuchadnezzar. And I can't think of anything more humiliating than to go through something like this. Well, it worked. At the end of that period, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and I praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing, but he does according to his will in the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And nobody can ward off his hand or say to him, what have you done? Okay, so God wins. God takes him down. Nebuchadnezzar finally gets it, but specifically, what was it that Nebuchadnezzar realized that really helped him grasp that pride wasn't the way? It's really two things that this passage focuses on. One is that he raised his eyes toward heaven. Look at this order of events. He raised his eyes toward heaven, and then his reason returned to him. And so this idea, if you feel like you're battling pride, A key way to overcome pride is to recalibrate your view of God. Now, I know a lot of us know some stuff about God, but often we just get kind of comfortable with what we do know. We lose our sense of wonder about what there is to know. And Daniel, if you've been listening all the way through this part of Daniel, he is trying to open our mind to see what an amazing God we have. These are observations he makes about God just in chapters 2, 3, and 4. Check this out. He says that he's the God of gods, the Lord of kings, a revealer of mysteries, a deliverer of servants. He's like no other God, and on 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 and on. All this, all the way through these chapters, different observations that he's making about God. That's an author trying to get our attention. That is Daniel telling us God is not us, but he, God, is all of these things. This is Daniel writing to his brother Jews who have been exiled, who lost everything they had because of their own pride, because of their own turning away from God. And he's like, guys, this is the true God. This is who we really worship. He's persuaded unless we can recalibrate and reappreciate how amazing our God is, we will never get free from pride. This is his whole main point. And so, man, if we all battle with this, what we need is not just a thing to do, but more of a habit to cultivate that will be an antidote to pride. So when you think about, like, what could we do to raise our eyes toward heaven? One thing you could start doing is just read this book on your own and go through, get a notebook out, and just note everything Daniel says about who God is. Create a list. Make a list of these things. And then next time you're facing something difficult, trying to help somebody or do a teaching or something like that, instead of focusing on all your inadequacies or focusing on how great you are, how about focusing instead on who God is and how great he is? Right? This is such a great antidote to just review, who is the God that I worship? What is he like? Not just a few things I know, but what is the bigger picture? What does the Bible say about who God is? Another thing that broke Nebuchadnezzar's pride, he says, the king realizes all the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. Now, he's not saying that you're nothing, that you have no value at all. But he's saying any value that we do have totally is derived from God. So you think about, you know, humans can make aircraft carriers, put people on the moon, ski down mountains that nobody should be able to ski down. You know, just incredible, amazing, swim the English Channel, whatever. They are amazing. They're stunning. But all that glory and power that humans have, that completely goes back to God. And that's the thing that Nebuchadnezzar couldn't get, is that everything, including even the breath he takes, was from God. So what about that? I just wonder if you have ever just thanked God that you can even breathe, let alone everything else. Lord, man, I was able to stand up. Thank you. I just couldn't have done any of this today, anything. I literally could not have gotten out of bed if it wasn't for you. That kind of gratitude, whether it's thank you for being able to breathe or thanks that we get to share a sunset together, whatever, Lord, thank you. Just open my eyes to see the different ways you've loved us. That's a key antidote to pride. I don't know if you guys remember John Stott. He was a pretty well-known scholar from the last century. I've actually written back and forth with him and talked to him a little bit on the phone. He's a super sweet, polite man. He gave a talk as an 80-plus-year-old pastor. And he, in this talk, admitted, I have an insidious temptation to pride. Now, this guy is the sweetest old man you could ever meet. If John Stott has an insidious temptation to pride, so do you, okay? You're guilty as charged just because of that right there. You know, and he said, you know, what I try to work on when I'm battling with this, he's like, thankfulness. It's just the soil in which pride doesn't easily grow. So true, Lord. Just I'm nothing without you, and everything's possible with you. Thank you. Those are two things right there. Instead of pride, focusing on who God is. That's something we can do. And thanking God for what he's done. Well, he says, Nebuchadnezzar says, at that time, he finally acknowledged God. My reason returned to me, and my majesty and splendor were restored to me for the glory of my kingdom. And my counselors and my nobles began seeking me out, so I was reestablished in my sovereignty, and surpassing greatness was added to me. So apparently they didn't replace him. While he was out, I guess they had some people cover things, but he was able to step back into power. And then he says, I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise, exalt, and honor the King of heaven, for all his works are true and his ways are just, and he is able to humble those who walk in pride. Isn't that cool? He's like, I was proud, and he humbled me, and he'll do the same for you. And it's just a really cool reminder, a whole arc of this story with Nebuchadnezzar, God never quit going after him. I used to go fishing years ago in this place called Quetico. It's a provincial park in Western Ontario. They have all kinds of fish here, but my favorite fish are the pike. If you catch them, they're not hard to catch, but they're hard to get in the boat. As you're reeling in, if they see the boat, they will take off and try to wrap the line around a submerged tree. They'll do anything. If you get them in the net, they'll try to flip out. You get them in the boat, they have these razor-sharp teeth, and they can literally bite your finger off. It's a tough fish to land, kind of like you. Kind of like Nebuchadnezzar. But God, he can put you on the stringer, and it's a good place to be. It's good to have the humility to acknowledge God's pursuit of you and to turn to him in humility and receive the forgiveness that he offers. And I hope you think that through, because it's better. It's better than living apart from God. So, okay, there you go. All right, Father, we are in varying degrees, you know, just caught up in this. This is part of the human condition. We're proud. We want to do things our own way. We want to call the shots. But you have proven through sending your son that you're the one loving person in our life who wants our best interest. You know what's better for us better than we do, Lord. I do pray, personally and forever, whoever here is willing, that you would put us on your operating table and have your way with us and help us learn to see you the way you truly are. Help us look up to heaven and recognize that you're the true God. Amen.